This podcast is sponsored by ebookit.com, self-publishing solutions for the independent author and small press. Visit us today at ebookit.com.
Welcome to the Toastmasters Podcast, the official podcast of Toastmasters International. Hello, everybody. This is Greg Gazin.
And I'm Ryan Levesque.
What we have here is a failure to communicate. I think we all know this line from the movie Cool Hand Luke. It's not surprising since these days we're so easily distracted, we're in a hurry, there's just so much going on. Now add to that differences in language, culture, and the lack of noise-canceling headphones, and we can certainly see we have some work to do. Ryan, I understand our guest today is going to help us break through that communication barrier.
Indeed, Greg. Dean Foster has been speaking, writing, and consulting for more than two decades on the nature of culture and its role in society, work, and politics in a globalizing world. Dean is the founder of DFA, Intercultural Global Solutions, and founder and former worldwide director of Berlitz Cross Cultural. Based in New York City, Dean has played a central role in the development of the field of cross-cultural training and consulting. Dean's article, Breaking Language Barriers, Top 10 Tips for Connecting with Anyone in the World, appeared in the June 2021 issue of the Toastmaster magazine. Dean Foster, welcome to the Toastmasters podcast.
A pleasure to be here with both of you. Thank you for the invitation.
Well, Dean, when it comes to communicating with people from other cultures, I think most people are well-intentioned. However, good intentions alone don't always lead to effective communication. So we're excited to learn from you today some principles and techniques to help us communicate more effectively cross-culturally. I mentioned that your article features a top 10 list, and we're going to touch on several of those points today, I'm sure. But I'd like to start with your number one point, as it strikes me as an underlying principle for all of the other points. And it is this: be respectful, be interested, and be humble. So to kick us off, Dean, could you bring some context to that point for us?
You know, the important thing, I think, when you're working across cultures, and I get this question all the time, because people are always, most of the time, maybe I'll take always back, but most of the time, very well-intentioned. And they're surprised when their best intentions don't work out. You know, I tried to do what I thought was right. I tried to do what was best for both of us. And yet we still misunderstood each other. We still didn't communicate as effectively as I would have had I been speaking with my coworker right next door. And so the basic point you want to always remember is that people are different. They have different cultural ways of thinking about things, of living their lives, of the way they want to do business, about the way that they want to communicate with each other. And therefore, I think you go into any kind of interaction with someone of another culture with a sense of humility. I don't know everything. I certainly don't understand where they may be coming from. And I want to learn from them, and I want them to be able to understand me as best I can. So I have to take responsibility for making sure that I'm understood. And fundamentally, that means managing the language differences and the cultural differences that are probably always going to be there. And that's your responsibility.
Dean, do you think that being in lockdown and the proliferation of Zoom, do you think that's made things better or more challenging?
Well, on the one hand, it's given us the impression that we're kind of more similar than we might have thought we were. I mean, after all, we can see each other instantly. We can see, and we tend to see, the similarities that exist between us, because that's what we understand. The parts we don't understand, we tend not to see. And so the proliferation of Zoom and online communications has highlighted, actually, the differences that are always there. They're literally in our face far more frequently than before. So I think it's kind of a double-edged situation. On the one hand, it gives us the opportunity to see more people who are different from ourselves than we probably saw before. But we don't understand those differences. We tend to mask them by looking for the similarities. there's an opportunity and a danger here. And, you know, the old Chinese symbol for the word danger is always a combination of the symbols for danger and for opportunity. The danger is that those differences that exist between us because of our culture and our language are probably more evident and more in our face through Zoom than before. The opportunity is that, gee, we now can learn something about somebody else that we didn't know before if we remember to be humble, to ask questions, and to expect that there will be differences and not similarities.
Dean, I've come across two extremes that I'd like to run by you. The first is the person who's so fraught with fear about making a mistake when they're interacting with people from another culture. They're so afraid of offending others, maybe even sparking an international conflict. And then at the other end of the extreme is the person who, like we talked about, they think, hey, I'm well-intentioned. I don't need to worry. I'm just going to be me and that should be good enough. Where would you identify the sweet spot between those two extremes?
Yeah, well, I think they're both kind of right, but they are extreme and you don't want to live in that space. You have to be authentic on the one hand, which means I am always going to be a guy from New York City. And that's who I am. And I carry that culture and that way of communicating and that way of seeing the world with me. And that's what makes me who I am. And I have to be true to that. On the other hand, I also have to understand that it may not be the way of others. And it is my responsibility to understand the way of others and to recognize that the way I'm perceived because of who I am may be different, and they may be making judgments about that, and that there may be a way for us to simply get along better, communicate better, get our jobs done better with each other based on the understanding of how who I am can make the other person feel. So I think that it's a combination of both. It's about getting away from those extremes, remaining true to yourself, and remaining humble to the fact that it is your responsibility to understand how others react to you.
Interesting. I was just thinking, you know, how would you go about trying to teach someone to do that? Because sometimes we don't learn, right?
The first step is often the hardest, which is to get people to recognize that the way they tend to do things may not be the way it's preferred to be done in somebody else's home and in somebody else's culture. There's a certain amount of, gee, I didn't know that they saw things differently. So getting people to be open to that idea can sometimes be difficult. But usually in my work, people come to this question about culture because they've already had some sort of experience that made them kind of open their eyes. It's usually around something like, I don't know why this isn't working, but we're just not communicating. We're not getting things done. I ask questions and I don't get answers. The language barrier makes it just too hard to have a Zoom conversation or a phone call. And gee, is there something cultural or linguistic going on here that I can help with? When I get that kind of a question, then I know that I'm dealing with someone who's beginning to recognize that there may be something cultural or linguistic that's on the table that they have to take responsibility for managing.
Dean, you've referenced a couple times now that it's our responsibility to make the communication effective. I want to play devil's advocate just a little bit and take the position of the listener who might be thinking, why do you keep insisting that it's all my responsibility? What about the other person? What's their responsibility in the communication?
Yeah, well, I think in an ideal world, both people have responsibility to do this, right? But it's not an ideal world, and I can't control my colleague in another country as to whether or not they have this awareness or have the same sense of responsibility for doing whatever they can to make our communication work more smoothly. In most cases, I'm working with people who have to work with each other for one reason or another. Maybe we're on a global team together, or maybe we're working in the same company, but in different countries. You know, at the end of the day, the bottom line is, if your colleague abroad doesn't have this awareness, but you do, then you need to do something about that. And maybe, hopefully, someday they will, and we can all be a little bit more kumbaya. But right now, I can't control that. The only person in this dynamic that I can control is myself. And so I have to take responsibility for trying to make things a little bit easier and better for both of us.
Thank you. I love that answer. And it's leadership, ultimately.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah, that's great.
I was going to say, I'm thinking about this awkward situation I had not that long ago. I was talking to someone overseas and he was speaking so fast, but he was excited and he was enthusiastic. And I think either it was a bad headset or maybe he was speaking through his onboard microphone and I think the fan was running in the background. I was trying to write down some notes, but the reality was I couldn't keep up with him. But at the same time, I didn't want to take the wind out of his sails. So what I said to him was, I had to interject because I had to stop him and I felt really bad doing it. I said to him, I have to write down some notes and I want to make sure I'm accurate in terms of what you're trying to say to me. But I find that it's really awkward. So how would you recommend dealing with these types of situations?
Ah, right. That's a really good point. Was it an accent issue or a dialect issue?
It was probably the combination of the two. But I think what was happening is he was speaking so fast that I couldn't make out the words that he was saying.
Uh-huh. Right. So when people speak their language at the speed that they're comfortable with to someone who's hearing English through an accent or some sort of dialect, then it sounds very fast because your ear is trying to make sense of sounds that it normally wouldn't have to. So your ear is trying to slow it down, but it's going by you much too fast. Mm. What I do in those situations is I admit it. Put it out there as an issue and do it in a kind of self-deprecating way. For example, I remember one time I was speaking to an Indian colleague of mine. And of course, Indians in India, educated Indians, have learned English because of the presence of the British in India for many, many years. But they're speaking English oftentimes with a heavy local accent or a Hindi accent. And so it's hard for me to hear and understand everything that they're saying. And they may also be using some local English phrases that are kind of Indian English. And I say that I-N-G-L-I-S-H, English, Indian English, which may not be familiar to me in the U.S. So it's difficult for me. And when those things happen, I usually put that out there as an issue, but do it in a self-deprecating way. Like I might say to him, Raj, let me interrupt for just a moment. I'm having difficulty understanding everything you're saying, and I'm sure you probably have difficulty understanding everything that I say because I'm from New York, and I probably use words that don't make any sense for you either. And I'm probably speaking with a New York accent, which may be making things difficult for you, and I'm sorry if that's the case. So let's both agree to slow down a little bit so that it'll be easier for both of us to understand each other. And usually that does the trick. We laugh about it and then we slow down for a bit. And then when we get excited about what we're talking about, we speed up again. But then we can say, but I need you to slow down, remember? And so it usually works out really, really nicely. You know, let's admit that we both are creating a challenge for each other. And that if we both slow down, it'll make life easier.
I was just chuckling, and Ryan and I were actually talking about this previously. We were talking about how this can sometimes be like a bad breakup. And when someone says, oh no, it's not you, it's me.
Yes, that's right. And it is you because you can't control them.
That's true. That's so true.
I also want to pick up on this concept of Indian English because there was something that I learned from your article. Your article drove me to Google to find a little bit more information. And it's this phrase that's used in Indian English, do the needful. I've received emails that included this phrase from customers who were from India. And I always assumed one of two things, either it was Google Translate gone bad, or that the person was being extremely rude. That's how it landed with me, as I'm being commanded, do this.
Yes, right. But
can you give us a little bit more color on that phrase and how it's used? And maybe even if you know why it's used in India, but not in the UK or in the US or Canada, for example.
Yeah, well, you know, English changes around the world. The good news is that the colleagues that you're speaking with abroad who are using whatever English they know, have already gone the distance to speak in your language. Mm. That, you know, you have to look at yourself and say, well, gee, have I learned French in order to speak with Jacques in Paris? Have I learned Mandarin in order to speak with my colleagues in China? The answer is probably maybe no, but maybe you have, but likely that you haven't learned the language that is required for global communications, which for the most part is some form of English. So in India, we speak English, and there are Indian phrases like do the needful that developed organically in India based on British English. And we don't use that phrase in the States, for example. And what it really means is, okay, now that we've discussed it, take the next step, implement, do what needs to be done. We've made a decision, and now let's just go forward. So it's not a command at all, and there is not any sense of telling another person what to do. It's simply a way of agreeing on what we've decided, and now we'll take the next steps. But there's lots and lots of those kinds of phrases. Like in India, you might hear your colleagues say, let's prepone this meeting. Well, that simply means the opposite of postpone the meeting. So it means let's push it up, let's advance it on the agenda as opposed to delaying it down the road. And in Singapore, we speak Singlish, which has its own phrases. And in the States, we speak a strange kind of English compared to the English spoken in Canada, no doubt. And everywhere we've got these strange local English versions of the English language. But remember, everyone is using these in their effort to speak English with you. So again, it's the least we can do to become familiar with these and to understand them when we hear them. And if we don't, again, let's reveal this issue and put it on the table. I would ask Raj, excuse me, Raj, you just said something that I don't think is familiar to me in the States. What does do the needful mean? And Raj will be glad to tell you about it because people typically love to talk about their culture. And if you admit that you don't understand something that they may have said that's cultural, ask about it. Just ask them. But sitting back and not knowing what they said and then scratching your head and wondering where we're going with this is, it's just going to slow things down.
Yeah.
Now, you might want to try to do that ahead of time as opposed to asking that person when you're ready to talk to them. So I'm wondering, so for listeners who might be traveling to another country physically or virtually, perhaps they're interacting with another culture or they're just curious, what are some of the ways or what are some of the sources that people can learn some of these do's and don'ts ahead of time?
Well, you know, Google is always out there, right? And so everybody defaults to Google and runs there and puts these things in and gets some fairly basic but reliable information from time to time. But I can be a little self-serving here and say there's lots of books you can read, including the ones that I've written, that can give you all this kinds of good cultural information about lots of countries so you can prepare yourself. There are podcasts you can listen to, like this one, and there are training programs that you can go to. So there's lots of resources out there for this kind of communication. And in a global world, and let's face it, that is what we are living in independent of political movements to the contrary, the toothpaste is out of the tube and it is global, a global world that we live in. It's our responsibility to become informed. There's no wiggle room for cultural ignorance anymore.
In hindsight, I might have said, and with respect to pathways, level one, project authoritative sources.
Authoritative sources, yes.
Cool. I'd love to take a look for a moment at the phenomenon that you mention in your article of words or gestures that might be perfectly innocent in one culture and highly offensive in another. You give the example of the okay sign that we use here in the United States, forming a circle by touching the tip of your index finger to the tip of your thumb. And that's vulgar in Brazil. And I've heard of several other things, pointing an index finger, showing the bottom of one's shoes. And of course, there are words that mean very different things here in the United States versus, I can think of one in Australia, actually.
That's right.
But should you find yourself in a situation where you say something or do something and the look of horror spreads across your interlocutor's face, how do you suggest attempting a recovery?
It's always easier not to break the glass in the first place than to have to put it back together once it's broken.
Well said.
So once again, we go back to this theme of you've got to take responsibility for not making the mistake that you made that caused the problem. But once it happens, then I think the best recovery is to admit it and basically say, I'm sorry if I said or did anything that surprised you, and that's not common in my culture. Could you help me understand why it produced the reaction it did in you? And I found most of the time we wind up laughing about it because these are unusual and funny at the end of the day. I remember one time I was in New Zealand, and I was referring to the different ways that people speak. Some cultures speak more openly, and some cultures kind of imply what they really mean. And a term that we've used to describe these two different modes of communication is there are coconuts and then there are peaches. And the coconuts are closed and the peaches are open, because coconuts are hard shell and peaches are soft on the outside. And I was immediately informed by one of my colleagues that the referral to someone as a coconut in New Zealand was kind of a negative term used for Pacific Islanders. It had connotations of racism. I was unaware of this, and I'm the first one who's going to make mistakes as someone who's constantly learning. And of course I said, well, in New York City, we don't use the term coconuts because we're not in the tropics. And I didn't know this. And my apologies for having used that term. And everyone laughed. And of course, the laughter was for my benefit, to kind of lighten the situation. But we moved on from it. And I admitted my lack of knowledge. I can't know everything. I try as best I can. And I think admitting it and moving on is the best way to do it, because everyone forgives and understands that you don't know their culture. You might not know their culture. What they won't forgive is once we tell you, if you continue to make the same mistake.
Right. Oh, boy.
For those listening, Dean, in our Toastmasters Club, we do table topics. And for those who are not familiar, it's table topics where you get 1 to 2 minutes to talk about, to answer a question on a topic or a theme of the day. In our club, we like to change it up every once in a while. So one of the things I like to do is I like to get a mixed bag of words that I select out of the dictionary. Pretty obscure words that I'll ask individuals, can you please define this word, knowing that they didn't, but asking them to give it their best guess. Nine times out of 10, they're wrong. But it's really exciting because afterwards we give them the correct definition. We're encouraged to, of course, improve our vocabulary, but at the same token, you encourage people in the article to keep it simple. How can you keep it simple, but not making it too simple, so that perhaps context is lost?
Well, I think you want to be, because language differences do present a barrier, you want to reduce the kind of words that you use to simple words. I always say, don't use a three-syllable word if you can use a two-syllable word, and don't use a two-syllable word if you can use a one-syllable word. So instead of saying something like, let's do this because it's more efficacious, I would say, let's do this because it works. And I think the process of simplifying actually forces you to think more clearly about what you're trying to say. And the use of sometimes very long and fancy words, for lack of a better term, is actually a default that we go to when we don't want to clarify our thinking. So I find the simplification process as one that's very helpful. And it's absolutely helpful to someone who speaks English as a second or a third or a fourth language, because they probably don't know efficacious, but they do know it works.
Do you find though sometimes if you have to use a simple word, you may have to give further explanation? So for example, you might be talking about a certain type of car. You use the word car as opposed to some other term. I'm just making this up as we go on the fly.
Automobile.
Yeah. Bad example. No. What I was sort of getting at is that sometimes you might use a word that's very simple, but doesn't necessarily give enough definition or enough context or create enough imagery in people's minds. Do you find that you may have to add some additional words in that, yes, in that case?
Yes. And I think providing context is an important cross-cultural skill. There are many cultures where context is implied and people speak in a way where it's assumed that everyone who's listening to me understands what I really mean because we share the same context. But when you're cross-cultural, you often don't share the same context. And if you're speaking with someone from a high context culture where the assumption is everyone really knows what I mean, even if I don't use all the words to say it, chances are you're not going to be getting all the information because you don't know the context that they're assuming you should know. So you do need to provide a lot more detail in general when speaking with anyone in another culture to ensure that they are understanding what it is that you mean exactly and that they're not making assumptions about what you mean. So yes, you may have to add more words, but I think it's better to add more simple words than to use one complicated word for which they simply have no knowledge.
That makes sense.
Dean, this has been both fascinating and a lot of fun. Can you share with our listeners where they can learn more about you, find out what you're up to, and learn more from you?
Sure. I don't mean to be, as I said, self-serving, and you do want to go to the authority and not an authoritative source. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to think that checking out the five books that I've written about communicating and working across cultures would be a good place to start. You can listen to our podcast. You can order our books. You can get more information about our training programs if you'd like to bring this information into your organization. And it's all available from my website. So that's deanfosterglobal.com.
Fantastic. And what's the name of your podcast, Dean?
And the podcast is Oops, Your Culture's Showing, where we have a lot of fun with managing these cultural differences.
It is quite fun. I listened to a little bit of it this morning, and I think our listeners would enjoy it. I'll also add a couple of other sources if folks want to continue to explore similar topics. We have interview 10 of the Toastmasters podcast on effective intercultural communication. And more recently, we interviewed Carol Bowser in episode 176, Brushing Up on a Foreign Language. But Dean Foster, thank you so much for joining us today on the Toastmasters podcast. It has been enlightening.
Greg, Ryan, thank you. A real pleasure.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you. Folks, if you've enjoyed this episode and you found it valuable, please make sure that you tell a friend to check out the Toastmasters podcast. It's also available on Apple Podcast and Google Podcast, on the Toastmasters website, and at toastmasterspodcasts.com.
Isn't it about time you published that book you've been thinking about? We can help with that. At ebookit.com, we've been providing authors and small presses with ebook publishing services since 2010. Visit us today at ebookit.com and let us know how we can help you.